This is Graham Davis, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 8th of June 2012. Graham Davis, Part 2.
Can we just pick up on one or two points from the first half of the interview about Signy, one or two things that didn't get mentioned at the time. One is, of course, the famous Signy toilet.
Yeah.
Tell me about the facilities at Signy in 1955.
54, yes, 54.
54.
Yeah. No, they had... They were perched on the edge of the... by the hut, about 10 yards away, 15 yards away from the main hut. And they had this magnificent view. You could sit on the toilet and see about 50 miles up up Coronation Island to the end on a clear day. And the only sound you hear would be bits of ice dropping off glaciers and thing. It was it'd been a real... attraction, a real soothing place to be.
Presumably it was was it chemical or just a long drop?
No, it was just a bucket. You threw the bucket away. What we used to use was the flour buckets, because the flour came in big tins, and we used to use those and then throwing them over to what we used to call Gash Cove, when the thing, which is
an area not to go swimming in.
Yes, right, yes. Anything used to go there, dead dogs, all your rubbish.
What was the superstructure of the toilet like then? Was it a little hut?
Oh, it was quite a big hut, actually. It's quite a big hut. I think it was a two-seater as well.
did anybody ever use it simultaneously?
No, I don't think so.
But if the weather was foul, presumably that was a deterrent, wasn't it?
Well, it depends. I mean, if you just wanted a pee, you just did it in the snow outside and that was it. But anything else, you just had to brave the elements.
So it wasn't heated?
No.
Did you get frosty bottoms?
Oh, yes. Not that I ever remember anything in particular, but I mean, I know it was extremely cold.
And was there a jetty at Signy to help unload?
Oh, yes, that's... another thing, the previous season they built this jetty using oil drums and cement and building this jetty. And when we went to Signy, they gave us a new dinghy because the other one had been damaged, so a new dinghy. We used it a few times and then we put it on. At night we used to haul it up on the jetty out of the water. And then one night there's this terrific gales blowing. And a big load of sea ice came in the bay and it took the jetty away with it and it took our new dinghy away with it as well.
Gosh.
And we'd only been there a few weeks and we had to ask for another dinghy.
Did he get it?
Eventually, yes. At the end, when the John Biscoe called again at the end of the season, we did get another one. Because we had this seagull outboard motor we used to have on it. It used to be a terrible thing.
They were notorious, weren't they?
Oh, we could never start them. You used to spend half an hour trying to start them. They're terrible.
Why were they so bad?
I don't know. It's just difficult to start. I mean, when they were working all right. There's no problem. But getting them started was the thing. They used to end up putting ether in the air vents to G up the initial start. They used to do that with the generators as well. You used to have a supply of ether to put into the air intakes to assist the easy starting of the generators, because they were big hand crank things. You have to crank them.
So how did the ether help in that?
Well, I think it's just it used to ignite, because they were diesel engines, these Enfields. Twin Enfields, horizontal twin Enfield engines were diesel engines, and it used to ignite quickly. And once it ignited, you know, you give it a little bang and a big powerful smoke, and the engine would start.
And we were talking about calling Antarctica, which you now remember listening to.
Yes,
and
that's
receiving
right,
a
yeah.
message from your.
I say we went back, and one day.
This is back in London, is it?
It's when we were back in London, yes, and one day. I had a letter saying, you know, if we wanted to visit Oxford Street Studios, Fid were invited to go up any time. And I remember that time Fid called Harry Dolman, just visited me in London that particular day. So we went up together and had a look around the studio, and there's a producer called Innes Brown, If you know the name?
I don't know his name, no.
No, she was...
Her name, okay.
Her name, yes, Innes. Yes, she invited us, you know, brought us a cup of tea in the canteen and showed us around the studio. In fact, once she did say, would you like to do a short programme on the overseas service, you know, about the Antarctic, and being a bit shy, I didn't... I said, oh, I declined, but...
Did you meet the presenter?
I met Peter King, yes, 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 he was there.
What sort of chap was he?
I can't really remember much okay. about him at all. It was only a brief meeting. I think he was working at the time, you know, just to say, how are you? Because his voice was familiar with us down south with this calling Antarctica. But, yes, as I say... This Innes Brown, I mean, she's the scruffiest person I've ever met in my life. She used to have a cream cake and she'd wipe it down the front, you know. Oh God. I've never seen such an untidy person in my life, but evidently she worked for the BBC for years.
Did you get any sense about whether she was committed to that particular radio?
Well, program? She used to produce it, yes. Yeah. She used to produce it, yeah.
So she was proud of it, or?
Oh, yes, I think so. Oh, she was, yes, she certainly was. Yeah, she said, oh, all your kids can come up and see me any time, you know, this sort of thing. She was getting on for retirement age, I would say.
When you came out of Admiralty Bay, you didn't come straight home because you went back to Falklands.
Oh, no, I did come home.
You did come home?
Yes.
Well, tell me what happened then, the sequence of events.
Well, I came out from Admiralty and I came home. It was... There was a bit of a problem because my mother had been taken ill. She'd been taken ill with cancer. And so they said they'd give me a flight home from Montevideo back to London. So that's what I did. I got the boat from the Falklands, which was the Fitzroy at the time, and got a plane back to London. And... looking around for a job again, I had a job. I took a job in a firm called Hillgorn Watts, which were instrument makers at the time in London. They used to make scientific instruments. And I worked for them for about 6 or 8 months. And then I got a bit fed up with that, being still in my early 20s. Well, this is something new. So I went up to Millbank and saw Eric Salmon, and do you want any operators this year? And he said, oh, well, we want one in Stanley. So I said, oh, well, I'll go to Stanley. So eventually I went to Stanley. Just like that, yeah.
No interview?
No, nothing. As I say, it was a bit of a slapdash organisation, really, that's what you call it. It's, they were making things up as they went along, sort of thing. But probably it worked because of that, because it was no thing. And at that time, I think they were just starting to get a bit more scientifically inclined. And I mean, before, all they did was mainly ionospheric work at Port Lockroy, but they used to, it was mainly surveying and surveyors going out, and the Met, and that was about the total sum of their activity at that time.
There was a more subtle activity, wasn't there, though, which was simply being there.
Oh yeah, being there is a more of a political gesture.
So you were aware of all that?
Oh well, because previously they'd had an incident at Hope Bay with the Argentines firing some shots at the British base. But to say, I did go to Hope Bay once, that's right, because I remember the ship called in there. I can't remember exactly when. And they, all this had been forgotten because they all the Argentines were drinking whiskey at Hope Bay, at the base D.
So tell me about going back down to Stanley then. Was this a career move, or just simply that you were fed up with what you were doing already?
Fed up with what I was doing, really. I hadn't any sense of a career move at that time. of a career at all, just as playing it as I went along. And I saw, as I say, it came there again. They must have been in a hurry because I flew down to Montevideo this time. They flew, and I picked up the Bisco in Montevideo. Oh, that's right, the Bisco had just left when I went up to see Eric Salmon. And,
flying in the early 50s was a bit of an adventure, wasn't it?
Oh, it was, yeah.
Tell me about that.
Well, I remember the aircraft going out was a Constellation, which is a massive four-engine airliner, post-war, one of the first post-war twin-tail airliners. That was quite an experience for me, anyway, not having... You know, apart from my trip home, I hadn't flown much at all.
So did you fly direct in either direction, or do you...?
Well, you do eventually. You don't. It's not non-stop. You fly somewhere, like you go into West Africa somewhere, Dakar, I think it was, and then refuel, and they go over to Brazil and down the coast. That's it, yes. So,
is this the era where people used to dress up to catch a plane?
Oh,
Sunday best.
Oh, yes. Nobody went scruffy. Yeah. Yes, I think at times of training, nobody would think of going in shorts on a plane or anything like that.
That's you. So tell me about settling into this job. You were there for nearly 4 years, I think, weren't you, at Stanley?
Over 3 years, yes.
Yeah. Were you one of the lads, or were you in charge?
Oh, no, I wasn't in charge. Lofty Tyson, I suppose you've heard the name.
I've met him.
Oh, you've met Lofty, have you?
Yeah.
All right, yeah. Has he done an interview?
Yes.
Oh, right.
I'll tell you about him later.
I was on the phone to him yesterday.
Good?
Oh, yeah, I see him quite often, yes, because he's in Doncaster. He was the in charge of the FIDS radio station in all... And... He equipped it. There was we were originally just in the Met Office, moving using this old American Army surplus transmitters, the same as on the bases, same transmitters. But when he moved us to Stanley Radio Station, we had a section of the Stanley Radio Station, and he equipped it. And he went, and there was used to be an Admiralty radio station at the end of the bay in Stanley. And I think they bought these transmitters off the Admiralty for £10 each. And he transferred them all up from there into the what was the FIDS radio station in the home of the government radio station.
So you were in the same building as...
Same building.
As Radio Falklands.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Were you working side by side with Lofty?
Oh, yeah.
So you're working on this together?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. We were putting aerials up and that sort of thing.
So was there an improvement programme going on? Was Lofty in charge of kind of upgrading everything?
Well, I suppose if you call installing a 25-year-old transmitter upgrading...
Well, he was, wasn't he, really?
Well, it's more power. I mean, these were powerful 4-kilowatt transmitters. They're massive things. They used to have valves the size of goldfish bowls in them.
Yeah.
And the upgrade, he set the station up because he was the one who went to Sydney after me to set up this new hut and all the wiring and the radio section. So, yes, he set it all up, really. He was in charge. And we really got on well. We had some local lads, apprentices, as working with us as operators. We had two, in particular three. One's still in England. Rody Summers, he's down near Southampton.
So was there kind of a constant... slow evolution of the facilities?
Well, I think they were. They were gradually getting better and better. I mean, we had, between our radio station, we used to take the message down. We had what they used to call a desk fax, which is kind of a primitive fax machine. And they we put the on the roll and it to send it to the Met Office, which was a few hundred yards away, or perhaps half a mile away from the radio station. So, I mean, facilities were improving and they had other transmitters. He eventually installed some other transmitters, but that were self-tuning. You only had to press a button. That was a great improvement.
So did that improve communications with the bases themselves?
Well, the thing is, they weren't voice transmitters. They were only Morse transmitters, CW. I don't think communication was ever bad, really. It was always fairly good. They maintained very few bases missed a radio schedule. And when I went to Stanley, they were just the same, except we used to broadcast a collective weather forecast, and all the Met reports we got from the base, we used to retransmit on a general frequency for all the Mets in South America to listen to. And we were quite busy with that, and I don't really think there wasn't a lot of difference between what we used to do. We were still collecting Met, and we still, except we were retransmitting them on certain times of day, and we got reports back from stations in South America or ships, the odd ships that were by. We'd take messages from Met messages.
The Morse code system you were using then, was that open for anybody to listen to, or were they still using one-time pads?
Oh, no. Because there was a system, they had the Marconi code book, which if there was anything that could be called private, they used to put into this code. You look up the book and there's a code for a phrase in the book. Hmm. And you just go through the book and pick out the phrases to pass on the message you wanted to.
But the Met information was just on general.
Oh, well, that was general. That wasn't encoded at all. But to say they encoded this was what they used to call the Marconi code. Mm. The only thing I remember that is the word for money is lolly, LOLLI.
Was this to try and fool the Germans, was it?
Yeah.
Did you use it much then? Were you getting much in the way of coded traffic?
Not a great deal, no. It's only if something happened on the base, you know, somebody had hurt themselves or been some accident or something like that.
Do you remember any particularly dramatic messages you had to convey? They're usually connected with disasters of one kind or another, aren't they?
Oh, yes. Well, I don't think they used the one-time pad as such. They might have done for extremely, but I don't think we ever got to that stage. Something is extremely important.
So what messages of that nature were you responsible for passing on? Newsworthy messages, shall we say?
Well, the only one I really recall is once when the Shackleton hit some ice in the Weddell Sea.
A growler.
Yeah. Hmm. And she started shipping water, and they threw all the hut that they were taking in Ali Bay overboard. Then they found it wasn't as bad as it was thought in the first place. That was Captain Brown.
Yes, I was discussing this a couple of days ago, where they had to throw a lot of the cargo over to try and heel the boat over to one side, so the tear in the ship's side was over above the water.
Above the waterline, yeah.
So you were hearing all that on your radio.
Well, he sent out... I didn't actually hear it myself, but we did hear that eventually it got to us that they'd been sending out an SOS... and had been picked up by a South African coast station, and they'd relayed it to London, and they'd relayed it to everybody else, and mainly to the whalers in South Georgia, because they were the nearest boats, the factory ships and the whaling ships there.
One of which didn't in fact go to.
Yeah.
Help.
Yeah. And then eventually they found it wasn't as bad as they thought it was. So.
Were there any deaths or tragic accidents that, in your time, that you were as you were in charge of the radio station at Stanley, it would have all come through you, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, there was, because there was a party lost. I don't know whether it's Port Lockroy or perhaps Ambers Island. They camped on the sea ice, and the sea ice broke up, and there's about three or four people were lost, and the whole lot were lost. Does that come up in your thing?
Yes, it's quite well known.
I remember the only member, I remember one of the members I knew quite well because I knew him in Stanley.
Who was that?
Dave Statham.
Yes, and Jeff Stride was one.
Yeah, yes, I remember.
Tell me about Dave, what do you remember of him?
Well, he was quite a jovial and a funny lad. He was always... He was always joking and laughing, and I would say that the soul of the party, you know, he was really upbeat about everything.
Heart and soul type chap.
Yes, that's right, yeah. Yes.
So how did that unfold, that story unfold for you in Stanley's radio station?
Well, we just got a message, it was, I think, in Clear, addressed to Secfids in Port Stanley, that the party had gone missing, they'd lost contact with them. And they tried various things, but I think some of the docks turned up later at other bases, yes.
So you were therefore, correct me if I'm wrong then, you would have known that one of the men missing was an old buddy of yours, would you?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And you were having to convey the messages back to London?
Yes, to Secfid, yes. Because there's not a lot they could do, really, but the only other incident I remember was when I was at Cygne, somebody at Port Lockroy had appendicitis, and there was some position, because they didn't have a doctor with them, and they suspected appendicitis, and they got advice on the radio, and there was evidently a certain position you could, if you got appendicitis, you're supposed to lay in or
adopt.
Adopt. Yes, for that, and eventually. The Argentines went down in a boat from another base, one of their bases, to fetch him down this La Mer Channel.
They pulled him out, did they?
Yes, they. I think they took him to the Argentine base where there was a doctor. Yeah.
Just going back to the David Statham story, so I'll just jog your memory, see if this does, in fact, remind you of something. There was traffic between London and the Antarctic about whether to go and try and find these men.
Mm.
Do you recall any of that?
No, I can't. Well, because the thing is, we wouldn't see that being Fitz radio station because it'd go to the government station, you see, to relay to London. It wouldn't pass through.
But the reply would have come through you?
Hmm?
Would the reply not come through you? Would he not?
Yes, I suppose it would. I can't recall. The thing was, we work sort of shift system there, and I might not have been on when that particular one came through.
Okay.
I can't recall it.
Fair enough. The Trans-Antarctic Expedition took place whilst you were at Stanley.
That's right, yes.
Were you aware of all that?
Oh, yes, because we were in contact with Halley Bay and the Trans-Antarctic Expedition.
The actual tractors themselves?
Yes, at times we were. Not in continual, in regular skeds, but they used to contact us from time to time. Because the operator on there was Ralph Lenton, and he was also the operator on the Biscoe when I went down.
So what do you recall of the radio traffic to and from the Transantarctic Expedition?
Not a lot, really. It would be personal stuff. Mainly, I think, I can't honestly say I recall much about the traffic. Only know that it was. Of course, then we were. There was an American icebreaker down there, the North Wind. She tried to contact, not to do with that incident, but to try to contact us for weather one day. And of course, the government radio station closed down about 6 in the evening. So that was it. And then they couldn't contact them, and they couldn't contact us. So they sent a message to their message to Washington, who relayed it to London, who next day relayed it down to Port Stanley. And they're only 50 miles off Stanley.
So did you send them the information next day?
Yeah. So I always thought, well, it's just 50 miles away, and it goes thousands of miles to get to.
It reminds me of mobile phone conversations these days. Where you might ring somebody else up in Scoldby, but it all goes via satellite.
That's right, yeah.
So whilst you were on Stanley for these 3 or 4 years, where were you living, Graham?
I was living, first of all, I lived in a boarding house called Mrs. McLeod's.
Quite famous.
Yes. And it wasn't, to be honest, it wasn't a very luxurious place. It was, everybody used to stay there from the camp, the shepherds and everybody, you know, she'd serve up mutton chops for breakfast, and that's it. And it wasn't luxurious, but then eventually I met a lady, you know, and she said, "Oh, Mrs. Smith," she said, "Oh, I take lodgers if you want to come." So I went to stay in her house for a little while, quite a while, nearly a year. She's very, very nice, very pleasant little house.
Tell me about the house.
Oh, it was like a little English country cottage, really, stone built, one out the back. And this massive garden. She's a very nice lady here, but she went to join her son in New Zealand eventually, so I had to find another place, and I found she passed me on to somebody else there, Mrs. King. She had a lovely house, big house. Her son was the town printer. He worked at the printing works in Stanley. And I saw at my time there, she's a very nice lady. Very old, but she must have been in her 70s then. But then she went to New Zealand.
Was there a tidal drift?
Well, there was a steady flow, I think, to New Zealand from the Falklands at the time.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Any particular reason, do you think?
I don't know whether they fancied it as it was an island, another island sort of thing. I don't know. And in fact, there are quite a lot there now. In fact, the how coincidence, you wouldn't believe. I say my disabled daughter's got a social worker, and she said once, "Oh, her name's Jennings." She said, "Oh, my husband's from New Zealand." She said, and I said, "Oh, I knew a Jennings who went to New Zealand." And I said, "Hamish and Gerald." She said, "Oh, Hamish is my husband's father."
There can't be that many Hamish Jennings around.
No. It's just an amazing coincidence.
How would you fill your time in the Falklands? I mean, or were you just in the radio station all the time?
Well, no. I mean, there was always quite a lot going on. We used to belong to a club called the Glue Pot.
The Glue Pot?
The Glue Pot. It was, you know, open all hours drinking sort of thing. At a snooker table, and we used to congregate there, and there was plenty going on in Port Stanley. There's always dances going on, film shows, and this is the Glue Pot, and there's plenty of other pubs as well. There's been about 6 or 8 pubs in this small town.
Was the Glue Pot somewhere that Fids went on a regular basis, or...?
Well, the Fids who worked in Stanley did, yes. Mm. Lofty Tyson, we used to belong to it, and the people who worked at the Met office in Stanley used to frequent it.
What were the attractions?
Well, beer, and you could be on your own, you know, you're a group on your own sort of thing, and you have little parties and gatherings there of people from the Fids office, and that... It was quite an enjoyable time there, but as I say, the roads were terrible. I didn't have any transport. Lofty Tyson used to have this big BMW motorbike, twin-cylinder motorbike, that he used to go to and from.
So would you not prefer to go to the Glupot rather than to the Globe, for example?
Well, I rarely went to the Globe. I don't know why. I suppose it's one of these, say, oh, I don't fancy it. No. Mm.
The cinema was quite famous, wasn't it? Was it in the Town Hall?
Yeah, yeah. Yes, the... Oh, in fact, one of the operators in Stanley... Oh, I forget his name now. But when I was working for GCHQ, I went on a course to Bletchley Park. And while I was there, I saw this chap who'd been an operator in Stanley. He'd come up for an interview for a job there in GCHQ. He didn't get it, but I was surprised to see him after about 6 years or so, last time I saw him, there.
So was life in Stanley was not dull then?
Oh, it wasn't dull, no, not in the least. I mean, if you felt like a walk, you know, there's plenty of walking and beaches and a bit on the cold side, half a gale blowing, most of the time, but really enjoyed them, yes.
Did you meet any young ladies?
Oh, there were some young ladies there, yes, but... Not very many. I think they were in short supply.
What happened at the end of your time at Port Stanley's, the Fidds radio station? Did your contract run out, or did you get fed up?
Well, I only went down for 3-year contract to start with. I did a bit more than 3 years, but I came back. And I didn't know... Oh, while I was there, I saw an advert... in this Wireless World magazine for operators for GCHQ. So I joined. So I wrote off and they from Stanley, and they sent me a letter back saying, I'll apply when you return to the UK. So that's what I did and got accepted and eventually went on a training course for GCHQ.
And the government communications headquarters was a career for you, wasn't it?
Oh, it was, yes. I was nearly over 30 years there, yes, 30 years. So I was only just 29 when I came back from the Falklands, and I retired at 61, so...
I'm conscious of the fact that you've got some notes there, Graham.
Well, I think we've covered most of it there, really. It's just to remind me, there's just a few bits and pieces. There's nothing we haven't covered. No, I don't think so. Everything in issue.
I'm just wondering, in all that time of your lifetime, how highly do the years with Fidds rate in your life?
Rate very highly. We covered everything that's on there.
Was it the highlight of your career?
I would say so. Yes, I enjoyed it. I must say, looking back, I enjoyed it quite well. The only other thing I've got here is that we used to have a Signy. We had a big steel oil drum. We used to have our baths in.
Tell me about that.
It's a massive, real heavy steel thing. I don't know whether it was an oil drum, but it was a big tub, like one of these Alibaba things made of steel.
So it was upright, was it?
Hmm? Upright, yes. You used to have to climb into it, and it had water from the tank that you'd heated in the... with the stove, because you had this stove that heated the hot water as well. So we used to have that. Because the only other thing in Stanley, of course, we had a tragedy. One of the operators drowned in Stanley Harbour while I was there.
Well, I don't know about this. What's the story?
Well, he liked his drink.
Right.
And... actually, he was an ex-Lancaster air gunner. And he used to knock around with a couple of the Falkland Islanders, and one night, evidently, they challenged him to swim out to one of the boats that was moored in these old vessels they used as warehouses stored in Stanley Harbour. And I think having a few, he went out there, he tried to swim out, and then he never came back, and they just left him and didn't they walked went home. and they never reported that he was found the next day. Suppose.
Do you remember the year and his name?
58, I would think. It must have been 1958. It's Stan. Oh, I forget his name now. No, it's Stan something. I can't look at it.
He was a fit, was he?
He'd been down on the bases, yes.
Yeah.
And for some reason, he hadn't done a full... only did a couple of months there, and then he came back to Stanley. So whether he said he didn't like it there, or I don't know what the story was on that, but he came back to Stanley anyway.
It's a small community, isn't it, Paul Stanley?
Yeah.
How would that incident have affected the community?
Well, I think there was quite a bit of upset about it, because these other two former liners had just left him, you know, and not mounted any rescue. And he was found on the beach the next day, drowned. But I think they all had too much to drink anyway. They're quite a heavy drinking crowd, the Falkland Islanders, anyway. But
did you get out beyond the camp much?
Only once. I went to a dance once at Fitzroy. Once, I think it was. That's the only time I went out. Walking to beaches and that sort of thing. We used to have one day. A frightening incident for me anyway was we got Lofty Tyson and said, board a boat, a dinghy, and they said, oh, we'll go out. So a crowd of us went out in Stanley Harbour with this outboard motor, and we got across, we got out, and then the terrific gale started up, and then the outboard motor packed up, and we were in the middle of the harbour, and it's quite choppy, and it's a small boat, and there's about six or eight of us in it, and we're all thing, and was trying to row ashore. It took quite a while to get ashore, you know. It was a bit frightening. Oh, that's a frightening incident for me anyway, not being a nautical person. But that's another frightening incident. I don't know whether Lofty mentioned that at all. No?
He may well have done it. It's a couple of years since I saw him, yeah.
Yeah, oh, right, yeah. Yes. Yes, he's not going to the reunion this year. He normally goes. He's 89.
He is, yes, he is. I think that's probably all I was hoping to cover, so you've done a very good job.
Yes.
So shall we call it today?
Yes, fine, yes, fine.
Thank you, Chris. Thank you very much.
Yeah, good. Thank you.